this is Mark Steiner, and you're about to hear another one of our Urbanite radio conversations. We're about to speak with historian and journalist Catherine Tumber, T-U-M-B-E-R, whose book is called Small, Greedy, and Green, The Promise of America's Smaller Industrial Cities in a Low-Carbon World. And Catherine Tumber, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm not surprised that Urbanite found this book, because they find these good books like this and bring them to the people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
But this book that you've written really does in many ways go against the grain of modern thought in the sense of where we should be, ought to be, and are headed in terms of our urban world.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see it as something that the whole notion of megalopolises that we think we're going to live in, from Boston to Miami, from Seattle to L.A., wherever those might be, you think are really a contradiction to who we are and where we need to go.
Well, the term they're using today is mega region. They're calling it mega region, and the idea is that they have that the best way to live sustainably is to agglomerate further and further into cities, large cities growing into other large cities, and finally into mega regions. This is this also is based on a growth model of constant growth, constant population growth, and how to accommodate the coming millions.
Mm-hmm.
I spent most of my life in smaller industrial cities of the Rust Belt, and also a good chunk of time in Detroit. And I watched them die, and grew alarmed that not only were they dying, but they were dropping out of the urban conversation over the past 30 years. And whenever you would hear people talk about cities, they only talked about big cities, how cities work. Only they'd look at New York, as if New York weren't an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really quite striking. And, part of the reason for that is that Jane Jacobs, who really launched the urban conversation in 1961 with her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, really was about great cities, big cities, not small cities. And the generation of urbanists, generations of urbanists after that, all cut their intellectual eye teeth on her work. And so smaller cities kind of just dropped out of the conversation. And, it struck me as it not only troubled my sense of justice, but it offended my sense of proportion and scale.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that the choices in anything aesthetically shouldn't be between something that's large and something that's small. In American culture, we talk about Wall Street and Main Street, the big city and the small town, and we've just forgotten about smaller urban settlements. But urban, emphasis on urban. When I really started to look into this, I was planning to just simply, bemoan the fate of these places.
Mm-hmm.
But when I really started to look into it, I found that they really are proportioned differently, and that things have historically worked differently in smaller industrial cities, and they have been they were disproportionately affected by deindustrialization and the disinvestment that led to suburban development. And on the brighter side, they have assets that can be put to use in a low carbon future. Assets that large cities, because of their scale, primarily lack. So that's how I came to this.
Well, I wonder, some of the things I guess anybody would think about in reading your work or thinking about this idea is that we have an idea that throughout humankind that people have been drawn to and size have created large metropolises, whether they be Cairo, Baghdad, Paris, London, New York, Madrid. And is that also not part of who we are, what people naturally seem to tend to do?
There's another tradition, and that is one of sort of a web of smaller developments that are devoted to the hinterland and dependent on the hinterland for food and subsistence, and that produce other kinds of goods that are small market towns and trading centers. And, you know, they tend not to be centers of the arts. And so we tend to, you know, not pay as much attention to them. But, you know, that doesn't, it doesn't have to be that way in the future.
Well, when you just said the arts, it's kind of a sense of the arts that people think of large urban areas as being that people gravitate towards for that reason. Maybe artists gravitate towards those from small towns for just that reason, to be in the midst of
Yes. But it's also true that, and here I'd like to read a quote.
Okay, please do.
You know, Jane Jacobs had a famous debate with Lewis Mumford, who was a, you know, famous...
Yes, you write about him in your book, A Great Deal.
Yes,
right.
And social critic. And she basically won that debate. And he was very clear that the reason why young people wanted to go to New York was because... I'll read you this quote.
Sure, please do.
Says. The gains that were made in Pittsburgh, Springfield, and Dayton were realized largely in New York, meaning the riches that were gained from the industrial system were spent by the financiers in New York to endow their museums and great art collections and things like that. And then he says, the fact that ambitious young provincials rushed to the metropolis in search of cultural vitality comes to something like an attempt to get back from New York what had previously been filched from the industrial city. So it's not necessarily that people want to be in these huge and growing settlements, the megalopolis. The fortunes that are made on these smaller places are spent on the arts and on that. On cultural riches in the cities, in the big cities. That doesn't necessarily have to be. We haven't tried it, you know, differently.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking about that just because living here in Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the same in people I know who live in Toledo or... I can name in dozens of small cities where there is a very strong artistic scene.
Yeah.
An underground scene that is going
mm-hmm.
on. But it takes place. It's very much alive. You know, Baltimore has the Maryland Institute College of Art and many other things, and people gravitate to here for that reason. But people then also gravitate to New York. So I'm saying,
it's
true. Because there's a draw, because the energy of being around thousands of people who are also in the midst of what you're in the midst of.
And there's a sense that if you're not, there's that, but there's also a sense that if you're not where the tastemakers and critics live, you won't be, your work won't get out into the world. And that's a consideration, too. It's a tricky question because, you know, there's a bit of Rust Belt chic going on right now, and there's a term I learned of just recently called the Rust Belt diaspora. People who feel like they can't stay in their cities, in their smaller cities, and they're being pushed out for lack of jobs to other places, other parts of the country. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that while that may be true, it's also true that people have always been doing that in smaller cities and you know, agricultural settlements. So it just, you know, I wrote this book to start a conversation, really. I was only able to touch on some of these questions, and this is just the kind of, you know, question that I hoped that it would prompt. And I don't, I really don't have all the answers. But I think it's important to consider these places as appropriately sized. I think it's important to include these places when we talk about urban life and mm-hmm. urban settlements, because they offer another alternative, and they also have many strengths. It's hard to see them right now because they're in such bad shape, but as we go into a period of, you know, low carbon development, which I hope will happen, you know, imminently, they have many strengths and assets that can be drawn from to revitalize themselves and to become really truly attractive places to live. With their own idiosyncrasies and their own histories and their own civic identities and forms of civic engagement. My guess is that it will look different there than it does in New York.
Yeah, I would say.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, I have a friend who, colleague who says, who has said, the metropolis has become the quintessential urban form. And these places have really, you know, been marginalized by that sort of emerging consensus over the past 30 years. And I think that, you know, it's time to consider other kinds of urban forms. The choices aren't only between the big city and the small town.
So what, when you think of that, and you could just as easily be talking about cities like Baltimore as you could cities like Flint or Muncie or Youngstown, which may be mm-hmm. smaller, but there's a lot of similarities in being Rust Belt cities and shrinking population, and always arguments over what to do with those cities. The arguments traditionally here are, of course, you have to bring in lots of very wealthy people, you have to build up your downtown to make it huge, and very expensive to live in.
Uh-huh.
And that this is the, and that we have to have these. Well, let's start with that. I mean, talk about the other visions of what cities like ours, whether they be Toledo or Baltimore, could become.
Well, I should pause and say that Baltimore is a little larger than what I look.
Yes, it is. I know,
But that's okay. Yes. And it's also in the Northeast Corridor, but has certain distinctive advantages that it can derive from that. I'm looking at cities that are more standalone. But having said that, I hope I just didn't distract myself by going off on a tangent. The value of smaller cities is that even though they have been gutted and they have suffered severe population decline in most cases, not all, they still are more densely settled than their surrounding suburbs, almost to a city. And they have good design bones. They could become even more dense. What they have is density and the potential for more density. So much of the justification for on sustainable grounds for the cultivation of mega regions is that it concentrates people. It creates greater density, so it creates more efficient delivery of energy to population centers and more efficient movement of people from one city to an, one metropolis to another through and, you know, high-speed rail. That's part of the vision. These smaller cities have, you know, they also have capacity for great density. But the vision that I'm trying to chart out is one that involves more of a web-like arrangement that is indebted to Lewis Mumford's vision of the city and the ecological region, and Patrick Geddes, the Scottish biologist, and Ebenezer Howard, who developed the Garden City idea in the early 19th century. He was British. In any case, that vision is one that involves concentrating people in the city, providing for food in a green belt surrounding the city, and preserving some of that land for, you know, public recreation, and developing a web of rail travel between these cities. Now, you know, this is a vision that emerged in, you know, industrial London, late industrial London.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vision that doesn't exclude, it's not intended to replace the existence of London as a financial center and a market center, and as a big city, but it's a supplementary vision to handle another way of understanding how the rise in population and the depopulation of the countryside could find a home in other kinds of settlements. That vision has often been criticized, since Howard articulated it and Mumford promoted it, as really anticipating the modern suburb. But that's not true. We see Mumford here. You know, he speaks very specifically, not of, you know, Montclair, New Jersey. That's close to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Newark. He talks about Springfield and Dayton and Pittsburgh. He's clearly talking about smaller cities. So, the population density of these places is one important asset that's often overlooked because they're usually collapsed into, you know, an identity as small towns, and they're not; they're cities. It's easy to forget that these cities sit amid some of the most fertile soil in the world. So they have a great deal to gain from preventing the eating away of that farmland for sprawl in terms of planning for, you know, a viable economic future in a low-carbon world. That's a very important asset that shouldn't be squandered, and yet, it is.
So
it continues apace.
Yes.
So, are you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to ask. So, I'm curious how the alternative vision works. I mean, I like the one idea that was in your writing was about, you know, we have this the fast travel, the slow train, slower trains can connect smaller cities.
Yes.
And that was an interesting notion.
Well, yes, the rail system started to be uprooted, and that's not just that's both trolley systems within cities, but also interurban rail lines. They call them the interurban. They started to tear those out in the 30s, as early as the 30s. But then, you know, the big slaughter happened after World War II, and this is all to prepare the way for the automobile as a preferred mode of travel, and the building of the highway system. Smaller cities. Here's another example. Smaller industrial cities were disproportionately affected by this because cities like New York, Chicago, kept their one of the things that's unpleasant for a lot of people who are, you know, urbanly inclined about living in these places is that it's really, there is very little reliable mass transit. There are bus systems. And in some cities, the bus systems are really improving dramatically. But this is one way in which they were disproportionately affected by federal transportation policy.
And the other vision of this, which I find really fascinating, is towards the end of your book when you really focus in on the changing agricultural world, both around small cities but also within them,
mm-hmm.
as kind of a harbinger of what could become, what could be the future.
This is another way that things work differently in smaller industrial cities. David Owen wrote a book that was widely read called Green Metropolis, in which he argues that that New Yorkers, because they live in such a highly dense city, have the lowest, among the lowest carbon footprints per person in the world, and that it would be it's foolish to promote things like urban agriculture when better to use that space and fill it with more people. And I agree with them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have basil plant in your roof garden or something like that, but that's not real substantial urban agriculture. In places like Baltimore and Youngstown and Flint and Detroit, urban agriculture makes a whole lot of sense because you have so much vacant property. I think that people on the East Coast who have never actually been to these places can't quite comprehend it, even though you see pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
The scale of it is shocking. And it's a way of pursuing urban agriculture is a way of even commercial farming is a way of bringing people together and having an investment in the land and creating a very low-scale economy, while also stabilizing these lots, which are just sitting there waiting for people to, commit sins on or something. I don't know. But it makes use of the land. And in these kinds of places, urban agriculture makes a great deal of sense.
Catherine Tumber, T-U-M-B-E-R, whose book is called Small, Greedy, and Green, The Promise of America's Smaller Industrial Cities in a Low-Carbon World. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, public radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.